1492, when America was engulfed in the Civil War and battling another slave state. Conflict with the Spanish colony of Santo Domingo and later country of Dominican Republic persisted for years. The latter remains hostile in recent years, expelling tens of thousands of ethnic Haitians, some economic migrants, and other lifelong residents. America's early intervention did not yield a sustainable democracy, while aid to the Duvaliers strengthened a brutal dictatorship. Since then, U.S. and U.N. occupations had no long-term impact, nor did the serial interventions in Haitian politics by George H.W. Bush and Bill Clinton administrations, the first mostly hidden, the second open against and for Aristide. Washington's more recent efforts in the West Asia region and Central Asia provide no evidence that it is any better prepared today to effect the internal transformation that Haiti desperately needs. U.S. military intervention would be a very bad idea. The U.S. remains more than a little busy in the world. Once in place, American forces could not easily leave. New tasks for them would be constantly proposed. There would be an election to run, a new government to protect, a political system to stabilize, an economy to develop, and ever more tasks of the sort proposed by Berg to complete. Hoping for the most, Haiti's ambassador to the U.S., Bocquet Edmond, argued, "A stable Haiti is in the interest of the United States. That may be an axiom of sorts given Haiti's proximity to America. However, that interest is limited. In traditional security and economic terms, Haiti is neither vital nor even important." Almost 30 years ago, Senator Joe Biden was asked about Haiti, which the Clinton administration had just occupied to restore democracy. He admitted that it was an awful thing to say, but if Haiti just quietly sunk into the Caribbean or rose up 300 feet, it wouldn't matter a whole lot in terms of our interests. He's right. That was awful thing to say, but it also was true. Instead of military intervention, Washington should focus on the threat of social collapse. Humanitarian aid would help, though it remains best delivered privately, especially by NGOs and expatriates, and delivered outside of the Haitian government's control. The U.S. also should honor its immigrant heritage by offering sanctuary to those in danger or distress instead of military intervention. As for larger political tasks, Washington should back efforts by the United Nations and Organization of American States. France also should lead in light of its historical interest in Haiti. A multilateral investigation into Ma's murder might be helpful. More critical would be delivering enough stability to allow Haitians to restore a functioning government. Only then would they have an opportunity to transcend their nation's latest political catastrophe. Haiti has been a tragedy for centuries because of interventions. The assassination of its president adds to the enormous accumulated misery of its people. They deserve so much better. International support could prove useful, but the past is filled with failures. Ultimately, Haiti's many problems will only be solved in Port-au-Prince, not Washington and any other European country.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود
قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
June 28, 2021, on the occasion of the National Judiciary Week and the martyrdom anniversary of Ayatollah Martyr Beheshti and other personalities. American and English media, as well as the media in some reactionary and notorious countries, focused all their efforts on our elections. Well, they had certain pretexts, an example of which was the people's livelihood problems. They were really hopeful about this. Some of the things that happened later on, such as the developments related to the verification or non-verification of certain individuals in the vetting process, were also used as pretexts. It might occur that I come to disagree with some of the viewpoints of the Honorable Guardian Council, but the Guardian Council acted according to its religious obligations. It is acting according to the law. They are devout and pious people who are committed to their religious obligations. They are acting according to their religious duties. I might not agree with one, two decisions made by them, but I believe that they are acting according to their duties. However, those people used these as pretexts. This is one of their pretexts. Subhanallah, hamdanillah, wa la ilaha illallah. Subhanallah, hamdanillah, wa la ilaha illallah. Allahu Akbar. One of the pretexts that they used was the people's livelihood problems. What they did was to create uproar about this in order to discourage the people from showing their presence at the ballot boxes. They really hoped that the people's participation would be about 20-25%. They expressed this hope explicitly. Well, despite all these efforts, the people participated like that. Despite the coronavirus, according to experts' calculations, at least 10% of those who did not participate did not do so because of the coronavirus. If we take this into consideration, then the overall participation rates will be about 60%, which is a good participation rate. Despite this, the people entered the arena of elections. They lined up from early in the morning and they cast their votes and then made enthusiastic comments on television. What does this show? This is a strong blow to those trying to create a boycott of the elections. The people stood firm. This is really an epic. It is really a marvelous movement created by the people. Those who endeavored during that time to push the people away from the elections are the real losers of the elections. Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. From the very heart of evergreen forests, under the starry sky of the desert, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains, close up, Iran.
Hello, I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. I am now at Beryanak Square in Tehran. From the noise you hear, it's quite clear that I am in a very crowded place. North of this square is the location of a street which has placed the Museum of Nature and Wildlife in itself. This museum is called Haft Chenar. Today we are going to visit this spectacular museum. Haft Chenar Museum of Nature and Wildlife is a combination of old architecture, green environment, and wildlife museum. This museum is located in one of the old neighborhoods of Tehran called Beryanak, in a street which has seven old plane trees. The old beautiful building of the museum is a masterpiece of architecture belonging to late Qajarid era. The museum has also a green environment, reminding the old beautiful gardens of Tehran. The building of the museum was used as sock manufacturer in 1931. This museum was then repaired in 1997 and opened as Haft Chenar Museum of Nature and Wildlife. The Wildlife Museum of this complex is a collection of different species of living and dead animals, including invertebrates, vertebrates, marine animals, reptiles, birds, and mammals. The area of this complex is 7,693 square meters, and the built-up area is 2,683 square meters. I am now at Haft Chenar Museum of Nature and Wildlife. Across from me, there is a beautiful brick-made building. This is a two-story building, and there are also other buildings around it. These buildings give me a strange feeling, as if I have traveled to the past time. Looks like a dream. I am now at the section belonging to mammals at Haft Chenar Museum. This museum keeps different species of taxidermy, herbivorous and carnivorous mammals. Oh, God! They are as if living creatures. Here we have ram, brown bear, and gazelle. On this side of the museum, we have lion, panther, Asiatic cheetah, and Persian onager. Here we have the Aquarium of Haft Chenar Museum of Nature and Wildlife. Here's like a twisting cave. Amazing! Different species of freshwater fish from rivers around the world are seen in this aquarium. Among the fish in this aquarium, mention can be made of predatory fish, catfish, and piranha fish. Oh, look! It's the freshwater salamander. It's very beautiful. I'm still at Haft Chenar Museum of Nature and Wildlife. Here, different species of birds are kept. Ducks, swans, flamingos, partridges, parrots, or even peacock. You should spend hours for discovering the beauties of this museum. I really can't take my eyes off all these beauties. Until next time, goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, since the victory of the Cuban Revolution against imperialism in 1959, Havana has been targeted and never forgiven by Washington. This after Cuba nationalized its own resources and threw out the American companies which were profiting from Cuban resources. Now, the United States could never tolerate this small nation daring to take a stand against it so close to American shores. Recently, there have been demonstrations as the Cubans continue to deal with harsh American sanctions, and the president of this island nation is pointing the finger at Washington once again for provoking and encouraging unrest in Cuba. Well, stay with us as we put the spotlight on Cuba this edition.
The rally in Havana with tens of thousands of Cubans taking part. They came together to voice support for the island's government and protest what they see as the U.S. meddling in their country's internal affairs. The rally was held just days after unprecedented unrest erupted in Cuba over an economic crisis aggravated by the coronavirus pandemic. Revolutionary leader Raul Castro and the Cuban president were among those attending the event.
We have come together to once again denounce the U.S. blockade, aggression, and terror. We could not put off this rally. The enemy has once again given everything to destroy the sacred unity and peace of citizens.
The Cuban president criticized the U.S. for spreading false information on social media. He also blasted Washington for defaming his government and inciting hatred and violence. He said the U.S. seeks to undermine peace and stability in Cuba. Criticism of U.S. policies vis-a-vis Cuba has not been limited to its shores. Russia has also accused the U.S. of plotting a color revolution in Cuba.
The logic is simple here. It has been tested on numerous occasions by Washington in various situations. But everything is the same, instigating color revolutions against undesirable regimes. At first, sanctions are introduced against them, and artificial problems are created or imposed from outside, which complicate the social and economic situation. On this basis, tensions are provoked, and anti-government sentiment is stirred up. When a critical mass is reached, the whole blame is laid on the national government. Labels are pinned on it, its activity is discredited, and thus the situation nears a collapse.
Iran, too, says the U.S. is the root cause of many of the problems in Cuba and should end its unilateral sanctions on the Caribbean nation. The bans were first imposed in 1960 in response to Havana's nationalization of U.S.-owned oil refineries following the Cuban Revolution. The sanctions were later extended. Even racial justice group Black Lives Matter publicly condemned the trade blockade, saying it's at the heart of Cuba's current crisis. In June, a total of 184 countries voted in favor of a UN resolution to demand an end to the US economic blockade on Cuba. Only the US and Israel voted against. That was the 29th consecutive year that the UN General Assembly called for the U.S. to end its Cuba embargo. Washington has ignored the international plea every time. U.S. President Joe Biden has called Cuba a failed state. The Cuban leaders deny that. But even if it's true, that claim serves more as an admission of guilt on the part of the U.S. than castigation of the island nation.
I'd like to welcome my guests to the spotlight. Out of Leesburg, Dennis Ma, Latin American expert. And out of Washington, D.C., Shel Labash, writer and anti-imperialist activist. Thank you both for being with me. Let's start this off with Dennis. Your perspective, how do you assess the effect of over 60 years of sanctions by the U.S. on Cuba?
Well, I think these sanctions have been wrong for each and every one of those 60 years. But unfortunately, what we're facing today is a very different context than what has existed until now. And I think that the current sanctions against Cuba and the activities in the Caribbean more broadly are actually very, very dangerous. What I mean is the following. We're facing an international financial breakdown crisis underway in the transatlantic sector. This is something which my magazine, Executive Intelligence Review, has documented in detail. And what you therefore have is among those big financial interests an intent on a radical shift in the direction of world politics as a whole. I think that the blockade and what's happening with Cuba is even worse than it has been described in two regards. First, it is under conditions of a pandemic that was mentioned, I think, very importantly so in your lead up to this discussion. Under current conditions where we have a global pandemic which is out of control, to impose sanctions on countries that are facing this is tantamount to genocide. And I would like to strongly agree with what the Secretary General of the United Nations, Antonio Guterres, has said which is that all sanctions should be lifted under these conditions. I personally believe all sanctions should be lifted altogether, but certainly under these conditions, what's happening in various countries with the pandemic, it makes the issues of sanctions and regime change and color revolutions all the worse. Mm-hmm. The second feature of the current development, which I think is really serious, is that it occurs along with similar and related activities in places like Haiti and in South America, and in South Africa as well, not just South America, but South Africa. So I'll leave that for further elaboration.
Okay, well, what about what Dennis said? I mean, he talked about the UN Secretary General Guterres and basically saying, especially under these conditions with the pandemic, that sanctions should be removed. What does that mean exactly? If the UN Secretary General is saying that, if the majority of member states are for that, but then nothing happens, nothing changes. So tell me, what's going on here? What does it all mean?
Well, it all means, as my colleague said, that there is a global initiative on the part of the United States to restructure the world under its domination. Those days are past, but they are not sparing anyone in their striving for hegemony. If you look at, of course, all of the sanctions should be lifted. It's unjust for unilateral economic war to be perpetrated on the people around the world. And Cuba's only one place. It's just the longest one and the one that's closest to the United States. But all of the sanctions should be lifted. I mean, has anybody looked at the fact that without a global response to the pandemic, the coronavirus is not going to go away? And the people who do not have vaccines are basically being thrown to death. And human beings are not expendable. That's a little bit the problem. You see this settler colonial imperialist attitude on the part of the United States saying, well, we're vaccinating people here. But the fact of the matter is, until the whole world is protected against the coronavirus, no one is going to be saved.
Let me cross back over to Dennis. I mean, it's part of a live program, right? Well, Dennis, your take on, you heard what Cheryl was saying. I mean, at the end of the day, what is the U.S. after in continually putting this type of pressure on Cuba? Because she talked about basically that every life is relevant and valuable, but it doesn't seem to be part of the equation in that settler colonialist mentality. How do you see it?
Well, I think you have to distinguish. There's different forces at play inside the United States, as there are in many countries around the world. And I think it's important to understand that there are distinctions in different points of view. Let me explain what I mean. There is an alternative that has been built over the last number of years internationally to the current bankrupt world financial system. And just parenthetically, when I say bankrupt, I mean bankrupt. You have $2 quadrillion in derivatives and financial speculation, which cannot be paid. And the attempt to hold up that bubble is what is behind the war drive. It is what is behind the austerity leading to the pandemic. It is what is behind all of these regime change operations, not just in a country like Cuba or Iran or Venezuela, but attempted regime change in Russia and China. That's what you're getting from the Wall Street and the City of London crowd. But the alternative that is existing at this point and that needs to be backed is what the Chinese have initiated with the Belt and Road Initiative, which many countries have joined in on at this point. In fact, the majority of the world's population, which has a different kind of approach to economics, which is not speculation and looting, but rather infrastructure and economic development. You can see the differences in the way the pandemic has been taken on. Now, we have an immediate situation around Afghanistan, which is, on the one hand, a very gravely dangerous situation, but also offers opportunities for a new kind of approach. Dangerous because with the departure of American troops, which is 20 years overdue after a 20-year war, and which many people in the United States, even included in the military, think that these perennial wars have simply got to stop. But you have a situation where, on the one hand, Afghanistan could easily tilt into becoming a center of world terrorism, of world drugs, of geopolitical destabilization and explosions. On the other hand, you have a confluence of forces coming together around the recent SCO meeting where the neighbors of Afghanistan, even though they have differences among them.
Okay. Well, now it seems to be Dennis's turn.
The forces that can actually help build.
Okay. Dennis, I'm sorry. I think it's your turn right now. We're having a little technical difficulty with you. Let me cross back over to Cheryl now. Cheryl, when we look at it, I mean, even when we're talking about the blockade or the sanctions on Cuba, I mean, isn't the main problem, it's not just the unilateral sanctions by the U.S., it's that the United States will punish or sanction any entity that actually want to have economic relationship with the country. Otherwise, if it was just the United States in itself, there would be so many other alternatives, but that it shuts down everyone and all other countries. Your take.
Yes, the extraterritorial nature of the blockade is really what is insidious. People in the United States, when they saw Barack Obama go to Cuba, it was like, everything is fine now. There's no blockade, relations are quote unquote normal. But the fact of the matter is, even then, the blockade, the economic sanctions, the economic warfare against Cuba continued. And what happens is the laws are so convoluted and complex that it becomes almost impossible to have trade. For example, to have a sale of pharmaceuticals, according to the U.S. law, you have to have a license. Okay, that's fine. To get that license, you have to agree to send a person to Cuba to verify that the end users are the end users. It's not a free and fair trade arrangement where people can, you know, Cubans can buy from the United States and people and businesses can sell. It's all controlled by the U.S. government, and they make the conditions so onerous that it's impossible to do. And then third countries, like, for example, one that's used frequently is that the embassy, the Cuban embassy in Canada, leased Honda vehicles. Should be simple. They go to a Honda dealership in Canada, they lease the vehicle. It turned out that Honda was fined for doing that because the financial route goes through California where their leasing office, their big international leasing office is. So even the small thing of leasing a vehicle, of getting deliveries from DHL, now remittances are cut because Western Union can't process remittances to Cuban families. The web is just so hard to negotiate, and it affects the whole world. That's really what's happening, and that's why it needs to end completely. There's the people of the United States are standing up against the blockade. We have resolutions from elected officials and city labor councils all across this country, numbering, representing more than 30 million people in the United States. We have people in every state of the union who will stand up and say, hands off Cuba. We are growing the movement here to tell the U.S. government that it is time to end the blockade and that we're not going to be distracted by this, you know, by all of these lies about what's happening in Cuba that are being fomented through a cyber war.
Dennis, you heard what Cheryl said, but I want to look at one aspect of that, because she talked about the growing numbers, the grassroots movement. But in general, is it about the numbers? Because if we're talking about majority, we know that 189 countries actually voted against continued sanctions. So she talked about 30 million people, for example, grassroots movement. Is it about the number of people that can pressure the U.S. government, or is it about the 1% which controls the U.S. government that actually, that's where they make the whatever decision they want to make?
I don't think it's either. I think the growth of 30 million people on policies that are appropriate is very good. But I want to emphasize that we're facing a different situation than we've been looking at for decades. There is a world financial breakdown crisis underway. That opens great dangers and great possibilities for a change in the big picture. If we don't change that big picture, the littler pictures, with all due respect to smaller countries, is not going to change. You have on the global strategic scene an alternative which is being put together around the Belt and Road Initiative, and that is an extraordinarily important counterweight, which is an area which people inside the United States should link up with. To bring sufficient pressure on this to change the situation, you're going to have to address the underlying blowout conditions in the world financial system and the economy, which is springing up these crises, creating these crises in various places. Listen, on this Cuba question, the president of Haiti was assassinated 4 or 5 days before the big demonstrations or the little demonstrations in Cuba, the unusual demonstrations. Within 2 days of the president of Haiti's assassination, one of the three governments of Haiti that was claiming to be the government called for the United States to send in troops. Now, as of now, the Biden administration has said no, but it's not a very strong no. And I believe this is a very real possibility, given that there are people who are looking for a war with Russia around Ukraine and a war with China around Taiwan. So I think it's very important to look at the big picture. People should recall that Cuba is closer to Haiti than it is to the United States. We have the proverbial 90 miles or 103 miles between Cuba and Florida, but there's 60 miles from Cuba to Haiti, and the part of Cuba which is closest to Haiti is Guantanamo. Now, I'm not saying we're going to have another Bay of Pigs tomorrow, but I am saying there is an intention from a policy layer internationally to create crises everywhere to maintain their global system in place, and it's a financial system. Therefore, I think it's most useful to look at how to affect that global problem, change that, if we hope to have changes in policy such as this not only criminal but really stupid policy, suicidal policy of sanctions against countries like Cuba or Venezuela or Iran and so forth. I mean, after all, we may think that we have a wall built around the rest of the world on the pandemic, but I would recommend that people read Edgar Allan Poe's story on the Mask of the Red Death as to what happens when people think that they can simply wall themselves out of a problem which is international, and the pandemic does not respect borders or anything of the sort. It's good we've got vaccines here. The whole world should have them, but the vaccines will not stand up to new variants if we don't guarantee that the entire planet is safe from this problem. So that's what I mean by the global problems.
Cheryl, your take, because we're just about, we're running out of time. What needs to happen to change the status quo? I mean, we've been looking at this since 1959, since the victory of the Cuban Revolution in that country, the continual pressure by the U.S., the sanctions by the U.S., the military aggression also, and threats. What has to change?
Well, what has to change is what we in the United States can do, because fundamentally, even though we laud the support from around the world and the voices from around the world, and it's very necessary, but fundamentally, it's our responsibility. It is a government that is acting in our name. And we have to really find a way, and that's why I emphasize that we've been doing this grassroots work. We have elected officials, we have elected bodies. I couldn't agree more that there are at least three, maybe more international crises that are transforming our world, not in a good way. One is the economic financial crisis, one is the pandemic, and the other is the environment. These crises are not going to be postponed. They're going to cause all sorts of problems and hardships inside our country,
okay.
Countries generally.
Okay.
So we have to step up the fight here at home.
And Dennis, 40 seconds, what needs to happen in your perspective?
The United States should join with China, Russia, and other countries in the Belt and Road Initiative. The fact that President Biden did sit down to talk with Putin is very positive, even though nothing particular came out of that, except the continuation of talks, recently a four-hour discussion. It is in the self-interest of the United States to work, for example, with China to build up the economic situation throughout the entire Caribbean region, Semexon. If you have illegal migration, you have to build these areas up economically and make them strong. And I think that this is something which the United States must be brought to understand is in our own self-interest.
Okay. And on that note, I hate to interrupt you both, but I appreciate you being with us. We're out of time. Dennis Small, Latin American expert out of Leesburg, and Cheryl Labash, writer and anti-imperialist activist out of Washington, D.C. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashim. Goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The deadly heat wave that recently pummeled the Pacific Northwest and southwestern Canada, described by a pair of climate scientists as the most extreme in the world weather records, killed nearly 800 people in Oregon, Washington, and British Columbia, along with over 1 billion intertidal animals. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Kenny Stansfield Ryder. This article is published under the heading, Oregon's Growing Bootleg Fire is one of 70 now raging in U.S. West, and where another heat wave looms. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. Bolstering the case for meaningful action to address the climate emergency, the out-of-control bootleg fire that began on July 6th in southern Oregon has scorched more than 280,000 acres and is only 22% contained. It is the nation's largest wildfire so far this year and one of 70 large blazes currently torching the U.S. West, which is bracing for yet another heat wave. To put bootleg's destructiveness into perspective, the fire, one of 10 burning in Oregon alone, has spread over 25,000 acres per day on average, or more than 1,000 acres every hour. According to CNN meteorologist Brandon Miller, that's an area larger than the area of Central Park each hour, or rate of a football field burned every 5 seconds for 11 days. As the Washington Post reported recently, the bootleg fire's expansion has destroyed 117 outbuildings and 67 residences in Klamath County, said Holly Craig, a spokeswoman for the bootleg fire incident management team. The fire is still raging in Lake County, home to a population of more than 7,000 residents, and the damage is being assessed, she said. outbreak added some 2,000 residents across both counties had been evacuated, with over 5,000 residences threatened by the growing flames. With an unprecedented wildfire season underway, the American Red Cross has opened 4 shelters throughout the state, said Chad Carter, the organization's Oregon Regional Communications Director. He said they are prepared to open more if needed. We are all planning for this to be a prolonged event this summer, Carter told the Post. We have got several shelters open right now, and we will continue to adjust based on the need throughout the summer. In addition to causing displacement, state officials said the fire has endangered parts of the power grid, specifically transmission lines that carry electricity to California, CNN reported. Allison Green, Public Affairs Director for the Oregon Office of State Fire Marshals, told the Post that we are seeing conditions that we usually see in mid-August. It's been extreme fire behavior over the last week that has created conditions that are certainly challenging. In an online update, Rob Allen, Incident Commander for the Pacific Northwest Area Incident Management Team 2, noted that the Booth Lake Fire perimeter is more than 200 miles long. That's an enormous amount of line to build and hold. Given its massive size and quick-moving pace, Ryan Berlin, a Booth Lake Fire Zone Number 1 Information Officer, told the Post that there is a pretty good possibility the Booth Lake Fire could merge with the smaller log fire, which blew up also. While the spark that caused the Booth Lake fire remains under investigation, very dry fuel is abundant in Oregon and throughout the western U.S., where a dozen states are battling 70 active wildfire complexes. For weeks, the region has suffered from record-high temperatures and a worsening drought. The severely hot and dry weather, which scientists say is inseparable from climatic disruptions driven by the emission of heat-trapping greenhouse gases, has created the conditions for an especially catastrophic wildfire season that experts warn is far from over. The deadly heat wave that recently pummeled the Pacific Northwest and southwestern Canada, described by a pair of climate scientists as the most extreme in world weather records, killed nearly 800 people in Oregon, Washington, and British Columbia, along with over 1 billion intertidal animals. According to a rapid response analysis conducted by a team of researchers, the dangerously high temperatures that helped make last month the hottest June in North America in recorded history would have been virtually impossible in the absence of the past 2 centuries of extracting and burning coal, oil, and gas, the primary source of growing carbon pollution. Mark Williams, a climate scientist at UCLA, recently said the same thing about the wave of wildfires now ravaging communities and ecosystems throughout the western U.S. We wouldn't be seeing this giant ramp up in fire activity as fast as it is happening without climate change, Williams told the New York Times. There is just no way. Drought and high heat, the Times noted recently, can kill trees and dry out dead grass, pine needles, and any other material on the bottom of the forest floor that act as kindling when a fire sweeps through out a forest. According to Joe Hessel, an ancient commander for the Oregon Department of Forestry, this fire is going to continue to grow. The extremely dry vegetation and weather are not in our favor. Hessel's ominous warning came as the U.S. West 4th heat wave in 5 weeks got underway in northern Rockies and high plains. Axis reported that temperatures in the area are expected to hit 20 to 30 degrees Fahrenheit above average. Experts fear that the impending high-pressure system known as a heat dome could exacerbate existing fires or contribute to the formation of new ones. According to the Times, parts of Idaho, 17 active large fires, Montana 13, Wyoming 2, and Utah 1 could be hit with triple-digit highs over the weekend and into early next week, with temperatures peaking. Ironically, one factor that could suppress temperatures slightly is a hazy sky due to smoke from nearby wildfires. CNN reported earlier this week that as a result of the ongoing blazes in the western U.S., most of the country, including states as far away as New York, could see at least light surface-level wildfire smoke. The news outlet noted that Oregon, Idaho, Wyoming, Colorado, and Minnesota issued air quality alerts. According to the Post, a major concern is the prospect of dry thunderstorms from the Sierra Nevada mountain range northward through much of northern Nevada, eastern Idaho, and central Montana. These storms could unleash cloud-to-ground lightning that ignites new blazes. Although he was pointing to this week's devastating flooding in Germany and Belgium, Representative Jamal Bowman could just as easily have been talking about the heat waves, drought conditions, and fires clobbering the U.S. West when he said recently that we are living through a climate catastrophe. Last week, climate justice advocates from the Sunrise Movement alluded to several extreme weather events and fossil fuel disasters that have occurred recently in the U.S. and came to the conclusion that the time for incrementalism is over. Bowman amplified that message, saying, "My colleagues in Congress have to understand we don't have 30 years. It's now or never. We have to redesign our economy to respond to the current crisis and to ensure it doesn't get much, much worse," he added.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.